Okay.
Here we go. So, yesterday, sectionalism and secession. Essentially, the 1850s. And so, we spent some time on that concept of sectionalism itself, and then the concept of states' rights. You really need to have a grasp on this and on this, especially. So, listen to those audio lectures as you follow along here. Then we got into the actual history of the 1850s as we're coming out of the age of land acquisition, Manifest Destiny Part 1, into, well, what's going to be top priority, and that's solving this slavery issue. Because remember, as we added states, one or two at a time, in the early 1800s, that issue of free state versus slave state always came to the forefront. But then it was settled for the moment, and we move on. But now we're at the end of Manifest Destiny, the end of the time that all of this territory is acquired, so there's going to be a bunch more new states. So that really elevates that issue of slavery, free states versus slave states, plus more years of emotion, North and South, invested in that. So that's the condition entering the 1850s, and we're not prepared for it. Listen to that lecture from yesterday. We're not prepared for it. New Party, Republican Party, listen to the lecture yesterday. Compromise of 1850, we did nothing on that yesterday because, well, we did that already prior to Christmas. Uncle Tom's Cabin, Kansas-Nebraska Act, Bleeding Kansas. So we are following sort of a moment-by-moment-by-moment path from the Compromise of 1850 to secession and war in sort of the same fashion that we did with between the French and Indian War and the American Revolution. So we're getting there. With every moment here, we're getting closer to secession and civil war. We closed yesterday with this Supreme Court case, Scott versus Sanford, which you know in a more familiar reference as the Dred Scott decision. So we are ready today, then, to start new material with the Lincoln-Douglas debates. I have mentioned Stephen Douglas a few times, and I told you that my guess is that many of you thought that Stephen Douglas was an 1850s version of Aaron Burr. Because what you know about Stephen Douglas, well, now it's different, but I mean a couple weeks ago, what you knew about Stephen Douglas probably was limited to this, Lincoln-Douglas debates. And so you know what a great guy Abraham Lincoln was, and let's see. Opposition? Well, the simple conclusion there is that as great as Abraham Lincoln was, well, then that meant Stephen Douglas, you know, is the bad guy. But you know that's not true. Stephen Douglas contributed in a positive way to U.S. history. So do not think, if you have, or you're at one time, or you're still doing it, do not think poorly of Stephen Douglas. The first, and then also, clarification, the Lincoln-Douglas debates, we'll look at the date, 1858. It's not about the presidential election of 1860. You probably already knew that. It was about, they're both politicians from Illinois. They are rival politicians from the same state, and then in 2 years are going to be rival politicians for the presidency. So, Lincoln-Douglas debates. This is all about an Illinois seat in the Senate. And they will campaign a series of debates, 9, I believe. Know this about Lincoln and Douglas. They really weren't that far apart in terms of political thought. They will both attempt to exaggerate their differences. I mean, isn't that the way it is in politics? I mean, how much sense does it make for Lincoln or Douglas to, at their point in the debate, to say, you know what, we think quite a bit alike. So, voters, take your pick. It doesn't make any sense. So they're both going to try to exaggerate their differences. Here's facts. Neither was in favor of extending slavery. So both wanted to see slavery confined to where it was in the United States. No difference there. Neither was willing to use force to end slavery. Military force, for example. That's just, you know, not the way to do it. Both considered blacks to be inferior to whites. A slight difference here. Lincoln, when asked point blank a question to that effect, would answer it directly. That's why we know how he feels in this regard. Douglas, however, was a little bit more willing to toss it out there, to advertise it, was a little bit more willing to toss that information about. But still, the point is, they both considered blacks to be inferior to whites. You'll run across someplace the Freeport Doctrine. I think it's one of your What's My Line items. That's associated with Douglas. And it gets its name from one of the debates in Freeport, Illinois, a town. And at that particular debate, Douglas went off on his on popular sovereignty, the theory of popular sovereignty, to determine the outcome for slavery. He was a big proponent of that. And so that's what the Freeport Doctrine is. Incidentally, those debates, think about this. Some of you, I know, the worst hour and a half of your day is A-push, listening to lecture. The worst hour and a half of your week, I should say it that way. Well, you got to do it twice. Think about this. These debates, here's the format. First of all, 3-hour debate. Public debate. All right. The format went like this, and it traded off from debate to debate to debate. The first speaker gets an hour. The second speaker gets 90 minutes. Then the first speaker back again, so the third speech, a half an hour. And that takes up 3 hours. Wow. And it really wasn't so much of a debate when you think of then, you know, back and forth. I've got, in terms of what you're used to today, to seeing on television today, where there's questions tossed out there and you've got 5 minutes to answer, and you've got 5 minutes to answer, even though you're not going to pay attention to that. You're just going to, both of you are going to go beyond your time limit, right? It wasn't like that so much. Yes?
So Lincoln-Douglas debating is something that's carried on Tuesday.
Oh, right,
I know,
right.
Because I'm a Lincoln-Douglas debater. Right. There's several other Lincoln-Douglas debaters in this room as well. But, you get, like, it's not 3 hours, obviously.
Right.
It's more like 20 minutes.
Right.
So you get like, the first speaker gets 5 minutes, next one gets three, and there's two, and then in there, there's time for you can question your opponent and be like, okay, can I see your card? Where's your information for this? That is the most common thing you hear in a Lincoln Douglas debate, though. Instead of, like, a long monologue speech, you hear, where's your card?
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah. I'm a former debater in high school. I've got a couple of good stories to tell you about that sometime. So, yeah, I'm familiar with all of that kind of business. Yeah. So the two opponents could have questions for one another, but then they would be handled in the text of that next speech. And then they might carry on. Then each of the two would adjust their approach so that their next debate, they'd be, attempt to be one up on their opponent as they went through the nine. Okay. And you all know the story, right? Douglas wins the election. John Brown's raid on Harper's Ferry, Virginia, is a precursor to the Civil War. So, John Brown, actually this is our second moment with John Brown, even though it's the first I've mentioned him. John Brown was part of Bleeding Kansas. John Brown had already made his mark in that episode known as Bleeding Kansas. He was responsible for a lot of bloodshed in Kansas, because he was an ardent abolitionist. And so there were a lot of pro-slavery Kansans who died at the hands of John Brown. Well, he will resurface in 1859 in Maryland to participate in just across the border from Harper's Ferry, Virginia. Harper's Ferry, that's a town. It's an odd name for a town. It's a town. So he and a small group, 20 to 30 abolitionists, will organize and plan and train for this episode. And let's see. Remember Burr's attempt to overtake the West? We know what happened right away, but then we can only guess what Burr had in mind. Well, same thing. This doesn't really get very far. John Brown and his men overtake an arsenal in Harper's Ferry, Virginia, just across the border from Maryland, where they, I believe it was just in a farmhouse, where they had been doing some planning and training. And an arsenal, remember, that's where, that's a storage place for weapons. It can be small, like the shed in your backyard, or it can be huge, like the gym, depending on what kind of weapons are stored there and how many. So they overtake this arsenal in Harper's Ferry, Virginia, and that's where it all comes to an end, this grandiose plan. Historians believe that the idea was that as this was occurring, the blacks from the area would reinforce Brown's small army by a matter of tens, And then the weapons would be seized, the weapons and ammunition would be seized, and John Brown and his army, now just a little bit bigger, would proceed on some sort of a private moral war against the South. And as they proceeded through the South, the news would precede them, and slaves would flee from their masters to reinforce Brown's army, so that at some point the army would be hundreds and then thousands of slaves. But that never happened. And then instead, federal troops surrounded the arsenal it was a couple days there. John Brown was wounded. A couple of his sons were killed. And John Brown then eventually arrested. And he will then be put on trial and executed for his actions there. That creates quite a turmoil, emotional turmoil, in the United States. Because there were those who viewed John Brown, because he was an abolitionist, period, and displayed a lot of energy in that direction, there's those who will view him as a martyr. There are others that will view his action, although wonderful at the base, you know, for the purpose, still not the way to go about it. I mean, death and destruction to get there. And so then there are others that will simply label him a fanatic. So, martyr or fanatic? I mean, there's that debate with John Brown. Here's what we know about John Brown that I haven't told you, that you have to consider here. I mean, for me, it's a no-brainer. But that doesn't have to be that way for you or for anybody else. John Brown was certainly off-center. Just to how much, we don't know. But his actions support that. Number one, his actions here and in Bleeding Kansas support that. Number two, a lot of family members were off kilter, were insane. And that, you know, that emotional distress can be hereditary. Doesn't have to be, but it can be. And so there's some logic to that. If John Brown would have had a great-great-great uncle who was off a little bit, then okay, maybe we can't make that connection. But there's several direct relatives who were. And then also, John Brown refused to the defense of temporary insanity. And that's the only thing that could have saved him. So he stuck with his defense without that plea, which meant certain conviction and then execution. And so there's a certain element of insanity there, too. At any rate, there's that famous painting, I think it's in Garrity, maybe Brinkley too, John Brown on the way to the gallows, and he's on the steps of the jail, being escorted by a guard, and then the image, I mean, of course, it's just a painting, so you don't see all this motion, but the image suggests that there's a lady who rushes up to him with her baby, you know, please kiss my baby. So that's the martyr aspect. In fact, Emerson and Thoreau, remember those two? Emerson and Thoreau martyred him. One of the two, I can't remember which one, compared his execution to the crucifixion of Christ. Wow. All right. So I think a parallel today would be, as I said, here's John Brown at the base of, why are you doing this? Well, abolition of slavery. Wonderful. Wonderful. That's a cause to believe in. And how are you going to go about this? Well, it's going to cause a lot of debt. I mean, how about a cause today that might be, there might be a lot of emotion invested, but on the way, there's going to be some sanctioned bloodshed to get there. I don't know, and you don't have to agree with me, but it makes no sense to me. Just makes no sense. I mean, the end justifies the means.
No.
Nah, I can't buy that. But, like I said, I'm giving you my opinion. All right. So, the epitome of fanaticism. And looking at all of U.S. history, I've said this before, the fringe elements get the attention, and they get a paragraph in the history books, but they're not the ones that bring about productive, long-lasting change, positive, long-lasting change. It's the moderates. And I've told you this before, I'm going to say it again. Do not think for 1 minute that moderates are any less passionate just because they're moderates. You can be every bit as passionate as extremists. It's just that you've outlined a more productive pathway to get your result about which you are very passionate. So don't ever trick yourself into thinking that moderates are not as passionate as are the radicals, the fringe elements. We're transitioning from sectionalism and secession into the Civil War. I'm going to stop this and start it because I've only got about 15 minutes left.